Please be seated. The panel's next case is Dr. Joel Slade versus Caesars Entertainment Corporation et al., case number 62720. Counsel ready to go?
Appellant is ready, Your Honor.
All right.
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Narcissian, are you ready? Okay. How are you? What's your name? Okay, welcome. And who do you have with you?
James Whitmire and yes. Jason Smith. Yes. I have the respondents as well as Elizabeth Nelson, Senior Vice President and Chief Counsel of Operations for Caesars.
Okay, welcome everybody. Thank you for being here.
Time to start?
Yes, sir.
Okay, may it please the Court, Robert Narcissian of Narcissian and Sankowitz, appearing for appellant and plaintiff, Dr. Joel Slade. Your Honors, ideally I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
The law provides that an innkeeper must accept guests properly presenting themselves and can only eject guests with good cause. Plaintiff sues because he has been denied guest status by the defendants in flagrant violation of this law. The duty of an innkeeper to accept guests is universal and recognized as universal under the common law. It is truly just this simple, and I quote, innkeepers, by the laws of all states, are bound to the extent of their facilities to furnish proper accommodation to all unobjectionable persons who in good faith apply for them. Your Honors, that's the United States Supreme Court referring to all states.
Counsel, in this argument, I'm looking at it because it seems very broad, especially the way these properties are laid out. Are you have a limitation, or do you want this to apply as of the whole property? Resort properties today, you have gaming, you have hotel, you have kind of a merger of the two. How should we be looking at this? Because I'm looking at the language very expansive based on the nature of how these properties have evolved over the years and the two conflicting positions, so to speak, within that.
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't believe that there's any conflict in the positions. Since time immemorial, the inn, the place where travelers stay and seek respite, etc., have always provided entertainment for their guests, and that's part of it. I don't want to suggest that this court is restrained from parsing out a new definition, and indeed, we, Dr. Slade, is, from his perspective, entirely satisfied with the innkeeper's duty. And if the casino were to be parsed out as for somehow not being part of the inn or not subject to this rule, that would be satisfactory for him because it is as an inn that he is especially...
I understand that, but as I said, we've had a merger of the public amusement situation. So looking at these two and trying to reconcile them.
First, and I guess this is what I'm saying, Your Honor, is I don't believe that they need to be reconciled if that's a hang-up because the court can take them apart. I would cite, as they did in the case of, in the case of Tyenda, I believe it was Tyenda versus Holiday Casino, they pulled out the valet and said the valet is not subject to the innkeeper's duties with respect to property taken from a room, and therefore the immunity that is given to, or the immunities that were there did not apply. Actually, it seems difficult to remove a valet from the, and I don't believe anybody on this panel was on Tyenda, but it seems difficult to remove the valet from the inn, but that's what the court did, while expressly recognizing that the hotel in Tyenda remained an inn and remained owing the duties and subject to the laws that were especial to an inn. Therefore, that's already been done in this state. But
he was barred from all casinos, all of Caesar's casinos throughout the country.
Arguably, Your Honor, that's what the letter says, and what it says is you will be arrested if you step foot on any of these properties. And I'm a little hesitant on that because it's a little bit weird as to who these defendants are. Strange, if I may. Because the defendants are Caesars Operating Company and Caesars Entertainment. Caesars Entertainment Operating Company and Caesars Entertainment, Inc., together with the hotel that Dr. Slade wanted to attend the conference at. The reason I point out this distinction is because the only people who could bar him under Nevada law would be an owner or an occupant, and Caesars Palace is owned by Desert Palace, Inc. It is not owned by Caesars Entertainment Operating Company. So even this warning, this letter, is ambiguous and just a scare tactic to keep him off of properties. And he's in here because they don't have the standing to give that order that they gave. Yet they gave it, and he has no doubt, and indeed experience indicates, that if he does step on their property, he'll find himself in a holding tank with a civil suit. He doesn't want a civil suit for false imprisonment. He wants to be able to attend conferences that these entities or their affiliates put on nationally, and they have truly taken on the character of a public accommodation, especially in Nevada. I pointed out in the brief that we have political conventions at these facilities, and they are asking this court to recognize that the venue for a political convention is under the sole control as to who can attend and not attend of an individual who is at the head of a casino corporation.
Counsel, can I ask you a question? In your complaint, which was attached, which we have a copy of, why was it important to make references to him being a frequent player in the casino and some other gaming type things when you were just talking about him going, staying in the hotel and going to an educational program?
Two reasons. The first reason is, as you look at the pleadings and what the complaint says, he was a net loser, he is a high-end player, and he's a doctor. He is exactly the very person, a doctor in a different jurisdiction. He's the very person that this state allowed the defendants to get a license, to entice them to be tourists in this state and spend money in this state. So that is, in the first place, part of his character as the person who we have granted license, we being Nevada, to these casinos so that they will bring them in. The second reason for indicating that is to show that he is also somebody who, in addition to pleading all of the right factors for Caesars in particular, that he is a non-objectionable guest, this adds an additional flavor to him being a non-objectionable guest. What is a better guest for a casino than a rate-paying person staying at a hotel who gambles big money at your joint and loses it?
Is he barred from any other casinos?
No, Your Honor. He has nothing in his history like that whatsoever. No. None.
Did he have any type of hearing when he got the letter? Was there any type of appeal that he could have had to see?
He did. He wrote and dealt with the, it's not in the record, but he begged them, let me back in, and they said, no, we're not going to. And without reason, again, Your Honor, I mean, that letter will come out in the pleadings, but there was never a reason given to him, and truly, there is no legitimate reason for him being barred, but it says so in the complaint, and that's to be accepted as true at this point.
So let me get this straight. Anthony Spilotro, who's deceased, was in the black book. He couldn't go in any casinos. Frank Rosenthal, he was in the black book. He couldn't go in any casinos. And Dr. Slade can't go to Caesars without being in the black book. So is there something wrong with that?
Is there something wrong with Dr. Slade not being able to go to Caesars?
Right.
Your Honor, the state is the one who took away the right of Mr. Spilotro and Mr. Rosenthal to be excluded from the casinos. They were determined, as I understand it, with some modicum of due process.
That's just Rosenthal was. I think he just couldn't be in
Stardust.
Yeah, Stardust.
But they were determined by the Gaming Control Board with some semblance of due process. I understand, as I look at it, there were appeal rights to that Gaming Control Board process, and you don't just get put in the black book. There are things you can do vis-a-vis the Gaming Control Board. He had his due process. Mr. Slade, Dr. Slade, doesn't get any, and it's not the state, and we're not here on a constitutional right. Mr. Spilatro and Rosenthal, had they come here on a claim of a common law right, which is what Dr. Slade is arguing, we have lost. Because one of the common law reasons, and this is cited in the brief, that a casino or any proprietor, an innkeeper, can exclude an individual under the common law is if they are a person of ill repute, whose repute, reputation, if you will actually or could actually injure the property. So even under the common law, Mr. Spilatro and Mr. Rosenthal could have been excluded, and there is no analogy and no relation there at all. The other case that, Your Honor, I see my time is up, and I would like to save the time for rebuttal. I thank you for the time that you've given me, and if there's a pressing question at the moment, I would be happy to address it.
We'll catch you on the next slide.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel, Jim Whitmire and Jason Smith, on behalf of the respondents, Caesars et al. The rule of law espoused by appellant, creating a four-cause requirement for a private property owner to deny access to a given individual, is not the law of the state of Nevada, has not been the law of the state of Nevada, and should not be the law of the state of Nevada. Stated otherwise, this is a direct challenge by appellant to the age-old rule law saying that a private property owner has the right to exclude persons for good reason, no reason at all, unless you fall into a protected class.
Counsel, let me interrupt you as you go down that. We have a facility that's regulated by the state of Nevada. We have an innkeeper, and we have a gaming establishment combined together. Pursuant to 651.070 of NRS states that all persons are entitled to full and equal enjoyment of good service facilities. So how do we begin to marry that with the right of a owner of private property? Because you don't have full to exclude everyone, because then we have the question, is it based on race, sex, other things? So how do we answer that question within what you're advocating?
Sure. I think that NRS 651.070 can be harmonized with the case law as well as Chapter 463.0129. Let me start, first of all, with NRS 651.070, the innkeeper statute. That statute states that all persons are entitled to the full and equal enjoyment of the goods, services, and privileges without discrimination or segregation, quote, on the ground of race, color, religion, national origin, disability, sexual orientation, sex, gender identity, or expression. That statute means, from our perspective, is you may not be excluded because of race or a protected class. It is undisputed that in this case, Dr. Slade falls in none of those protected classes.
And how do we know that?
Well, he was not excluded on that basis.
Based on what's been at least presented that I'm aware of in the record, it just says he was excluded, no reason given.
The complaint is the complaint never says I was excluded because of a protected class.
But does it say why he was excluded?
Does it have that specific allegation that he was excluded because family members were using his player's card excessively? I don't think plaintiffs pled that particular basis.
That's
for the
what I'm trying to establish.
Sure.
Whether or not what our predicate is for this argument we have.
Sure, understood. But what is crystal clear is that not once in the joint appendix of the complaint is there any mention of race, sex, national origin, or other protected class, which I think would have to be alleged in order to fall within the protected class under NRS 651.
And I say this, from a standpoint of whatever decision that this court makes on the subject matter is important, and this court understands that. So trying to understand what is at issue here, the big picture and also the intricacies, so we're not overbroad or oversimplistic in terms of what we are doing.
Understood. And I will address the practical implications in just one moment. NRS Chapter 463 provides the broad statement saying, be open to the general public, however, reserving the specific right to exclude persons, quote, for any reason. There's that carve-out, that the statute expressly preserves that right. The case law is all over the place. Franceschi, SOC Mirage, Spilatro, Mates, Houston, these are cited at page 6 of our brief that stand for the general proposition that a proprietor of a privately owned entertainment establishment may exclude whomever he wishes for any reason or for no reason whatsoever, citing to the Marone United States Supreme Court case. Shifting to the issue, the practical implication of what's at stake, I've thought about that exact question. And let me give a couple of real-life hypotheticals that, frankly, are pretty sobering situations.
Before you get to that, counsel, I think the point is that in the absence of an allegation of a protected class or race discrimination, then what you're urging is that the court follow that general precedent in the common law that would allow exclusion for any reason.
I agree with that, Justice Hardesty.
Now, in the argument, appellant has argued that 461 abrogates the common law. I'm not sure how that argument's made in light of the express language in the statute, but could you cover that while you're up?
We just have a fundamental disagreement concerning the interpretation of that statute, and from our perspective, if the statute was intended to mean what they say it should say, then the legislature could have said everyone gets to come in unless there's good cause for that person's exclusion, which that statute does not say. Mm-hmm. So there's just a fundamental battleground concerning the proper interpretation of Chapter 461.
Is there anything at all in the legislative history behind 461 that suggests for a moment that there's to be good cause determinations for exclusion?
Not that I've been able to find.
Okay. Go ahead to your practical.
Sure. The practical implications are this. You're an operator of a hotel. There are a sea of people everywhere. The owner of the premises may, security officers in particular, have to make an on-the-spot judgment call, for example. Is a person dressed too risque? Is a person appear to be a little bit tipsy, but perhaps not over-the-top intoxicated? Does the security officer have the intuition that this particular person, I've just got instinctually, this person looks like they're up to no good, but I can't articulate reasonable suspicion, I can't articulate probable cause, I didn't see any evidence in plain view, I can't move on this suspect, so to speak. The rule of law that is espoused by appellant would put the burden on my client to prove cause on the spot, and if they're wrong, and if they can't prove cause, then my client is subjected to a suit for, as alleged in this case, quote-unquote damages. That is a scary proposition as the owner of a property. To shift the
burden. To your hypothetical, how do the properties handle the exclusion of an African American or an Hispanic or an Asian who is behaving the way you've just described and not subject itself to the claims of the innkeeper statute of being excluded as a protected class?
I respect that question. My hypothetical was race neutral. However, if there is an allegation.
In reality, you wanted to offer some real hypotheticals, so I would assume that people other than Caucasian are dressing in risque ways or are tipsy but not clear what crime they may have committed. So how does a property deal with the innkeeper exclusion issue?
Agreed. I understand your question. They better not be excluding because of race, sex, sexual orientation, or a protected class.
And if but that the point is, it isn't necessary for this panel to address that hypothetical in this case because that's not the basis for exclusion here.
I agree that race and or another protected class is not the basis for exclusion in this case. I wholeheartedly agree with that proposition. The issue I am...
But the thorny hypothetical is a case for another day.
Fair enough. That may not be right on this particular panel. However, the implications of their argument, it's a very slippery slope and could open Pandora's box, especially with respect to persons who may be litigious and want to have their...
The consequences of the hypothetical on a race-neutral example is invokes the common law question, not the innkeeper question.
I think I agree with that because, well, it does not invoke the innkeeper because we're not talking about protected classes. And on the common law issue, it's good reason, bad reason, or no reason at all. And we fundamentally also disagree with the proposition that we have a look back to the common law of England in the 1800s or what have you. First of all, the decisions back in the common law, the Lidbitter decision, where somebody was excluded for a theater for no reason or whatsoever, we think that supports our core argument. However, to the extent that there are any issues that are inconsistent with that the Nevada statutory provisions of 651, 463, and the case law override that, I would also note this as a practical matter. The innkeeper in 2014 is far different than the innkeeper in ancient England in the 1800s. We are not talking about a situation where somebody may be put out into the countryside in the dark of night and in the cold of night to fend for themselves in the elements and or that sort of context. In 2014, there are hundreds of hotels within Las Vegas. There are probably thousands of restaurants in Las Vegas. Dr. Slade has plenty of other accommodations available to him. The point was made by the appellant in their brief that some of the old protected classes, for example, a blacksmith, are no longer applicable in the year 2014. Even if there is case law that may arguably support their proposition, we respectfully submit in the year 2014 the innkeeper protections that may theoretically exist under their perspective from the 1800s should not apply today.
What? Is there a difference between the permanent exclusion and the temporary exclusion, like the risque white person that's excluded versus the doctor who's permanently excluded from Caesars?
I don't think so. I don't think that there's any distinction legally because, as a core matter, the fundamental issue here is a private property owner's right to exclude for a non-protected class reason. Whether it's permanent, temporary, just for the night, just for a few hours, go out and have a breather, or permanent, from our perspective, it doesn't matter.
What concerns me about the position advocated by appellant, and if we adopt that position, then I guess the question is, how does a 7-Eleven exclude somebody, or a grocery store, or we have in front of us a gaming establishment, but if you adopt that common law approach, you have to give good cause in every exclusion in properties that are non-gaming as well.
I agree with that, and that is a very scary proposition, and the courthouses will be flooded with litigation by the person who is either litigious or wants to challenge the authorities or wants to...
Justice Cherry and Justice Douglas are anxious for more cases, so I don't know that that's a scary consequence.
Well, I'd probably invoke a Seventh Circuit reasoning from Judge Posner about how the costs of doing business might skyrocket, and that might be detrimental to the casino industry.
I guess the question is, if race and protected class isn't invoked in this case, then it seems to me the analysis is the common law and whether we adopt appellant's approach or your approach to the common law. I'm not even sure that 461 is implicated except for the public policy declaration of access to the property. Doesn't this case come down to a policy decision by the court in determining what Nevada's common law is on this point?
I answer this way. I think that the policy decision and the ramifications of what appellant is suggesting is an additional reason not to adopt their position. Mm-hmm. However, I fundamentally fall back on the position that, A, the common law rule, from our perspective, is that you could exclude for no reason whatsoever, consistent with Lidbetter, if I'm pronouncing that right.
Also, with all due respect, we have come, fortunately, a long way from some of the common law positions. And right now, when you turn on your channel and you read about establishments not wanting to provide service because someone believed in same-sex marriage for pastries or other things, and the courts are looking over this. So we are in a much different time when we talk about establishments that are outside the pure area of private property. They are private property with a plus because they are then sanctioned by a government entity to do business and to hold themselves open. So that landscape somewhat changes. Yes, you went to a hypothetical about being concerned when somebody appears on your premise. I'm concerned in this establishment, this one, because prior to the person even coming to the establishment, they receive a letter. And I understand potential liability. It says you can't come in. They allege my person has not done anything to warrant this. I'm law-abiding. So where do we draw the line? Do we look at this that I'm a Democratic hotel, I can exclude all Republicans. I'm a Republican hotel, I can exclude all Democrats. I'm a male hotel, no females, same sex. What do we do?
May I respond?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Justice Douglas. First of all, if the allegation in the complaint is that the exclusion was because of sexual orientation, sex, race, or a protected class, then under the state of the law, my client would be subject to defending itself in a lawsuit, and under that scenario, it'll be in front of a district court defending itself and let the process play out. However, if it's just a situation of...
But your ultimate position was, we don't have to tell you, we can just exclude you.
Well, but the allegation...
That's what you put forth. So I'm testing that with you at this point.
Yeah, and the triggering event is going to be an allegation by the plaintiff as to the basis upon which they are excluded. If it falls within a protected class, my client has to participate in the case and defend itself. If, however, it's we were excluded without any reason, just because, and I'm a lawful, law-abiding citizen, without an allegation of a protected class, that there's no claim as a matter of law because it doesn't fall within a protected class and it falls within the ordinary bundle of a private property owner's rights to exclude pursuant to either the common law, Chapter 463, and or NRS 651.070 and NRS 0.1.030, which says if the common law is inconsistent with the common law of England is inconsistent with the case law, these other statutory provisions, then the common law of England does not control. I certainly respect the notion that there could be a person who may not gain access because they, quote unquote, didn't do anything wrong. However, as the Brooks case stated in the Seventh Circuit, market forces are going to kick in. And if an operator starts arbitrarily doing these sorts of things, the market forces are going to take over, and that business is not going to survive if they start acting arbitrarily. But market forces are different than opening up the courthouses to permit every litigious or non-litigious person from coming in and saying, you know what, I was excluded for no reason. And here's my last point is this. Where we see this doctrine invoked all the time in a slightly different but analogous context is in the area of employment law. Employers can engage in all sorts of unfair conduct, such as, I don't like the color of your shoes, you're fired. I don't like your personality, you're fired. And those are non-actionable fact patterns. However, once you cross that line into sexual orientation, sex, race, the other protected classes, all bets are off, and the courthouses are open for those sorts of cases. Our position, fundamentally, has never intended to shut the courthouse doors on a case where an allegation is made that somebody was excluded on a protected class. Rather, our fundamental objection is this notion of a broad for-cause requirement that gets foisted on a property owner and shifts a fundamental burden of proof and fundamentally erodes the property rights that have been upheld by the courts for centuries. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Romine. Counsel?
Justice Douglas, gentlemen, I would like to point out that you brought up, Mr. Whitmire just responded with protected classes and went right to one of the questions you asked, but he did not address the Democrat or the Republican hotel. Okay, there are reasons, and they are before this court, where this does have an effect on society and isn't limited to protected classes. Also, the statute that Your Honor cited.
So isn't that something the legislature should address? If they want to extend protections, they did in the Innskeeper. Why can't the legislature, or shouldn't the legislature, address whether we should prevent Democrats from excluding Republicans?
Your Honor, they, with respect to innkeepers, the legislature did not. That's common law.
Why is the innkeeper statute invoked in this at all? You didn't make an allegation that this is a protected class claim, right?
Right, but it's not the there is no innkeeper statute. Mm-hmm. I've invoked the innkeeper
common law
duty to accept all comers. And I'll go again. It's not archaic. This is the United States Supreme Court now in 1995. Innkeepers, by the laws of all states, are bound to the extent of their facilities to furnish proper accommodation to all unobjectionable persons who in good faith apply for them. That's Hurley versus Irish American Gay Lesbian Bisexual Group of Boston, United States Supreme Court, 1995. If the court were to go look at Cox, In re Cox, cited in our briefs, which is really addressing, through analysis, much of what has been raised here, in In re Cox, that was a mall deciding, you know what, we don't like how a hippie is dressed, so we're going to put him out. And on an analogous civil rights statute, what the California Supreme Court noted in In re Cox is, yes, the statute talks about protected classes, but if you look at the whole statute, that is to assure that those protected classes get the same protections that are entitled to all persons, and that includes access to public accommodations. Now, if we look at our statute on the same issue, it starts with all persons and then puts out the protected class. The statute within its own four corners says that Dr. Slade is entitled to this protection. And then, in context, what it goes on to say, and we are saying this because we want to make, this is the legislature, especially certain that gay sexual orientation or race or religion doesn't come into the equation.
Counsel, what we have before us today, that has not been alleged.
I understand.
And the legislature did do a carve-out, whether I like it or don't like it, as to common law rights to exclude. So how do we consider that?
Addressing that, Your Honor, it did. And the carve-out says, and this is what is consistently not being pointed out. If you look at NRS 463.0129.3 sub E, it says nothing herein abrogates or abridges any common law right to exclude for any reason. Now, that for any reason, that would be the reason set forth in 651.020, which is the codification of the common law, which provides that they can eject for disorderly conduct and those other myriad of reasons that the common law already accepts. Destruction of the property, things like that. Failure to pay. All the reasons that the common law gives, so the any reason are the reasons that already exist under the common law. What you can't do is you can't have a legislature creating common law, and here because that's not what common law is. So here the legislature refers to the common law, and then you have to look to the common law as to what those reasons are. Now, we know with respect to an innkeeper, two Supreme Court cases, I think there's 34 other cases cited in the briefing that deal with the innkeeper's duty, and it is repeatedly noticed that this is a universal rule. An innkeeper must accept Dr. Slade as a guest unless they have a good reason to exclude. Now, what the defendant is asking this court to do is to step up and say, we are going to jettison 500, 600 years of the common law, and we're going to do so. Well, he hasn't given a policy reason. May I continue for very briefly?
Finish your thought.
Okay. They are asking that this exclusion, anyway, when we're dealing with modifying the common law to this degree, he's talking about the flood of litigation. Your Honors, five states, Missouri, New Jersey, California, Pennsylvania, and Maine, have a duty of public accommodation for all places that hold themselves open to the public. Not one case is cited from any of those jurisdictions by the defendant. Not one. And there is no flood of litigation. This doesn't breed litigation. What this breeds is a fairness in society, and in the case of Nevada, the ability to continue to attract tourists. I thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you, counsel, for your excellent briefs and argument today. This case will stand submitted.